Good evening, everybody. I'm Jim Ladd. Tonight, we are proud to bring you the realization of a long-awaited goal, to present an interview of George Harrison, who was always my favorite member of the Yardbirds. As a word of preparation for what you're about to hear, we will not spend a lot of time on history tonight, because I felt that rather than ask George to recount all those stories that I would love to hear again, I was more interested in where he was at now, as opposed to how long the breakup would last. So with that in mind, we'll now meet a very special and gifted musician who arrived at my house promptly at noon, and as he was politely explaining that he had to catch a plane at 5, we began our interview of George Harrison.
The only thing is I've got a plane to catch, and I didn't pack yet. My wife's packing some of it, but I need to get back to do that.
Ah, very good.
I mean, of all the days to do it, you know?
Yeah, if we can get an hour and a half, see, because we also have music in this.
Yeah, but that'll make it 3 hours, won't it?
No, we're not going to give you 3 hours, sir. We'll give you 2 hours, possibly.
No, I mean, if you put music in as well.
Oh, I see. So you're not a big fan of the show either, huh, George?
But to tell you the truth, you know, with not being here that often, when I do come to town, I don't, you know, I listen to a bit of radio. I don't listen to too much. It drives me crazy, you know.
Why is that?
I don't know. Well, it's just because of, you know, the commercials all the time, and after a while I just get dizzy with it. I probably got the only car in LA with no radio in it.
Okay, thank you for coming up, George.
That's it,
man.
Well, how long have you been in the business?
Oh, about in the radio business?
Yeah.
9 years now.
Well, I've been in it for 18.
In the radio business?
Well, no, in the music business.
Oh, I see. I was reading that you don't particularly care for, like, a lot of the loud stuff that's out nowadays.
Well, I think after all the years of doing it, you know, I mean, I prefer, if I want to hear something noisy, I'd still rather hear Little Richard, you know, or something like that, yeah. Old stuff. But I don't know, it's just part of my nature. I've always preferred a tune, you know, a melody. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that doesn't eliminate everything. No. One side of me is trying to calm down, you know. The other side gets agitated. You listen to that. Yeah, I mean, it can drive you crazy after a while.
Well, it's you guys' fault. I mean, this is them English punks, again, your fault. So.
Yeah.
Us Americans are over here listening to Joni Mitchell and Leonard Cohen.
I know, yeah. Well, I think a little bit of each is okay. It's just when it becomes too concentrated, you know, when it becomes a fad and that's all everybody's playing and doing, it drives me crazy.
I think a lot of people were hoping that, and perhaps in England, I'm certainly speaking out of school here, but perhaps in England, the punk thing was more than a fad, but over here it was just totally clothes,
yeah.
You know, and that was as deep as it went.
I think even in England it might have lasted a little bit longer than it did here, but it was a fad. But that's desperation that came out of, like, in England. You have to appreciate, like, England to realize why the punk thing happened, I think. You know, those kids are sort of brought up not such good education, they're brought up in poor surroundings, and they're sort of trained to become working in factories, you know, maybe bolting on hubcaps or something. And it's like out of that, the desperation of, you know, so naturally the thing is to try and destroy everything else, you know, around with the music. People have been saying to me, well, what do you think it's going to be like in the 80s? Well, I know, the 60s. We and others worked hard to try and generate that positive feeling. And then in the end of the 60s, it sort of went a bit strange. And then the 70s just scattered around. And it was a bit, I don't think the 70s, it's had, you know, one fad after another, but nothing really long lasting or that positive. But generally, the attitude I noticed disappeared, you know, just even if people weren't that sincere, they were trying to be, they were pretending to love each other. Well, I don't know what's the best. Maybe it's better if somebody just shows you what they feel, you know, rather than make a pretense, but it did feel very positive, you know, in the late 60s. and then it sort of just disappeared. I don't know where it went to, but I'm sure there's somebody out there who's still has that hope.
On a more current level, the new album, I want to ask you some specifics about the tunes, you know?
Yeah.
In the song called Faster, which starts the album out, is this like
That starts side two.
Starts side two out.
That's the story really on that tune is that since I was a kid, like 12 years old, I got into motor racing and motorcycle racing. Not actually racing myself, but as a spectator. And there was a track, racetrack in place I was born, Liverpool, where they had the Grand Prix races from time to time. So that I started doing that when I was about 12, just before I got into the guitar. It was always interesting to see in other areas in life who was wearing the long hair. And in motor racing, Jackie Stewart became the world champion in, I think, 1968. And he was the first guy with long hair and who had opinions, and he was a big Beatle fan. I had a book that Jackie Stewart had written, which was called Faster. So I thought, good, that's the title. So I lifted the title, and once I got the title, I was away, see, because I didn't want to write in about, first gear, second gear. So I tried to write in a way that was like a story, and it would also relate to people who weren't into motor racing. The only thing that limited is the sound effects that I put on later. Those guys, Niki Lauda and Mario Andretti, and those, I played them the song, and they were amazed. They were saying, I think they were, because they see people come to races, and they see some famous people coming, and, but that's it. I think they were amazed how, they were saying, that's it, that's exactly what it's about, what it's like.
It also seemed to me like it could be, and I know no one's ever tried to read anything in your lyrics, George, but... almost like a metaphor for, it could be a metaphor for other walks of life, like the Eagles' Desperado. Yeah,
exactly. Well, that's why I tried to, I thought a long time about how to write it so it wouldn't just be a corny tune. And it's more like it could be applied to anybody or any type of life or situation where somebody's successful, except it's limited then to the racing when you put the sound effects of the cars on it.
We'll be back with our interview of George Harrison in just a moment. I'm Jim Ladd, and we're back now with our interview of George Harrison.
But as far as the concept of success is something which is ringing up the cash register perpetually, so if you're not a success, that is, if your records don't get in the top 20, then you're not a success. But that's maybe true materially, but or as far as the music business goes. But for me, the success for me has been being able to keep sane and keep on the one thing that I plugged into, because I'm sure people thought it was a fad too. For me, Indian music, India, the spiritual thing, okay. But I tell you, that's stronger now with me than ever it was. Like the first Indian raga I ever heard, I can play that tune today, and I can enjoy it twice as much as I did back in 1965.
But I really like the fact that you still dealing with, the search.
Well, that's one thing that for some people can be a fad, but for me it's the whole purpose of life is to find out who am I, what are we doing here? Some people tend to think of it like, the purpose of life is just to come down here, make as much money as you can, screw around, and then you die. But, there's much heavier investment.
Since the time that you, let's say, actively stepped on this path, by the way, where was that? Was that the first time you went to see the Maharishi? Would that be?
No. I think what happened was in sometime in the 60s, the big thing happened when John Lennon and I went to dinner at this dentist's house, and he put LSD in our coffee. He dosed us, and we just went off on this trip, and that was it. You know, what happened to me was like, it was just like lots of doors in my mind was just flying open, and there was a lot of things which I knew instantly, which now I believe to be all part of what they call karma, previous karma, action reactions, and you know, I'm a big believer in reincarnation and all that, and I think you know, all those deja vu things you experience, it's all part of the whole trip. And at that time I realized, just through looking at the grass and the trees, you know, and I could see the sap running through the trees and everything, and I just knew that there was such a thing as God. I suddenly felt happy that there was some connection, that we were all connected to this energy. And just like we sit here and talk now, the energy within me and the energy within you is the same. And not only that, but I could see the space between us was buzzing too. And then I got into meditation. Well, I went into India then with Ravi Shankar. I was playing sitar, and I was trying to find out as much as I can, because part of the thing that I was left with after acid, I kept having these thoughts on the yogis, the Himalayas and all that. And I don't know why, but I was so attracted to that all the time. And so I went with Ravi, and I wanted to find out as much as I could. And I got to the point where I knew I just needed to get into mantras and meditation and all that sort of thing. Then I went and found, you know, Maharishi, who had been in England for 10 years lecturing. And the year we went, well, I went, and then John wanted to come too, and then, then Paul wanted to come. Anyway, we went there, and that year the press slagged him, saying, you know, I'm just doing this to get the Beatles and all that, which was really untrue. They hadn't written a word about him in 10 years, but because the Beatles went there, then he became hot. So, you know, it just led from that. And the thing is that, you know, the more you find out, the more you want to know, and it gets deeper and deeper. But the thing is, you're going towards something which is very nice. It's very attractive. And so maybe that's why, you know, for me it just snowballed. I was almost brought up as a Catholic. That idea of, look, you're not going to ever see God, he's dead, we killed him 2,000 years ago. The first thing that I got turned onto in Hinduism was a guy called Swami Vivekananda. And he said, if there's a God, we must see him. If there's a soul, we must perceive it. Otherwise, it's better not to believe. That's why in My Sweet Lord, I said, I really want to see you, because now I know you can. My sweet Lord. In the end of My Sweet Lord, it goes from Hallelujah into Hare Krishna, Hare Rama, and then at the end, there's a whole big Sanskrit prayer, which is called Guru Vandana. It's the Guru of Gurus. It's Guru Brahma, Guru Vishnu, Guru Deva, Maheshwara, Guru Sakshat, Param Brahma, Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So there's all that going on in the background, yes, as well. That's a direct result of that Swami Bhaktivedanta that I talked about, because that method of chanting, of repetition, of mantras, japa, they call it japa yoga. It's like rosary beads, you know, and you just repeat these mantras over and over and over again, and you get so high. I tell you, once you get it going, it takes a while to get that feeling going, but once you get going, it's hard to stop, because it's just so good. It makes you life sublime.
If you just joined us, I'm Jim Ladd, and you're listening to an interview of George Harrison.
Anybody want some refreshments?
Now for something completely different. Let's talk about Soft-Hearted Hannah, George, which is, if this is an ode to the mushroom, I ain't sitting
it
here.
It is.
All right.
I must admit.
Okay. That is one of the finest God creations in the world, though, I'll have to say.
That's, yeah, but I tell you, you have to be a bit careful, because they're so good. Yeah. The difference between an acid, when you feel half of you is feeling elated and the other half is feeling physically rotten and, ooh, you know, jumping about. That stuff is very organic, you know. It sort of felt great. Everything's in perfect focus and even the physical body feels good. But because I felt good, I just kept on eating them.
Oh, yeah.
All day. I nearly did myself in. I had too many. And I fell over and left my body.
Oh, yeah?
Fell over and hit the head on a piece of concrete. but they were great. But that was a, you know, little da-dum-dum.
Little
know,
lesson there.
It was.
Now, there's this line in here about the Lone Ranger smoking doobies said you're breaking all the rules.
Yeah, because in the place on Maui, there's this seven pools where everybody goes skinny dipping. But you're not supposed to because the tour buses come, the hula hula buses come up with all the tourists on. So there's a ranger who's around there and he sort of tells people to get their clothes on. It was just all the various little things that had happened on that trip around Maui. You know, and then I need some lyrics, you know. So that's it, the Lone Ranger telling them to put the clothes on.
Do you still think that most people want you to come out and be George the Beatle? And
yeah.
Yeah?
I think, you know, if I was to do a concert tour now, I could do one way which would be risky, and that is to go and do like I wanted to do in 74. This is me. You know, this is what I feel, and this is me, take me as I am, or let me go. Or I could go out and be, you know, sing all the nice songs, all the songs that people want to hear, and sing them just like I did them on the record. And that would be a huge success, I'm sure.
It never ceases to fascinate me how with all the things that you guys talked about, let's say beyond the boy-girl songs. I mean, it was constantly more and more about personal freedom, opening yourself up, start educating yourself, and yet people want you to just...
Well,
you're listening to the record and going, God, that's a great idea, and then when you come out and do it...
I know, they don't apply it. It's like Uncle Bob said once, winter is coming, the windows are full of frost. I tried to tell everybody, but I could not get across. I want to be your lover, babe, I don't want to be your boss. Don't say I didn't warn you when your train gets lost. You know,
train gets
it's like
lost.
How many times must a man look up before he can see the sky? It's like that. How many times do you have to tell somebody something before they, you know, I know people who say, you know, like, for example, my sister-in-law in England, who's a very sweet person, when John Lennon did that album, just the John Lennon album, you know, he had those real heavy songs about, you know, mother, you left me, and you know, all those real personal things. And she said to me, I mean, is that just a song that he's written, or does he feel that? You see, so people can't, because a lot of songs that people write, like I heard a song, what was that, Slip, Sliding Away, Paul Simon. When I heard that song, I thought, well, I've sort of hung out a little bit with Paul Simon. I said, God, I didn't know his mother died when he was only 4 years old and all these things happened to him. And another friend of mine who knows Paul, he said, no, that never happened. That's just, he just wrote that in the song. The difference is I couldn't do that.
Yeah.
You see, I'd write what really happened. And I couldn't sort of make up something that is untrue because somehow it just doesn't fit in with me. You know, it's like untrue. I can't even conceive of that. But some people do that, so maybe it's true that the public half the time don't know if you mean it, or if that is your experience, or if it's just a song.
Now, on that same subject in the song, If You Believe, you say, get up, you have all you need, and pray.
Pray, right? Give up, and it all recedes away from you. I don't know if you must have heard Lord Buckley. You know, well, there was a thing he did called God's Own Drunk.
No, I'm not quite.
I think it's that. Anyway, it was some one of Lord Buckley's things, and he was talking about love. He said, love is like a beautiful garden, and when you use it, it spreads, but when you don't, it recedes. And it's true. It's really that, in its simplest form, I'd say, is just positive versus negative. If you apply positive thought, even down to something like if you say to me, hey, make me some coffee, if I think, sure, that energy is there to do it. But if I think, oh God, can't you get it yourself? It drains you, the negative thought. And it's that simple. If you think, oh God, what can I do? My life's a misery and all that. As you're thinking that, you're actually putting fuel onto that negative draining aspect. Whereas, and this is hard, I'm not saying I can do it, but it's something that when you realize it, you can at least try and correct yourself all the time. So when you make an effort to do something, just like today, I could have easily stayed in bed and not come to do this interview. You know, ring ring, hey Jim, sorry, you know, I got a late night, you know, see you next time. But instead, you know, I thought, no, I can do it. I'll get up, I can do it. And it's just that simple. So get up, you have all your needs. Give up, and it all recedes away from you.
For someone to have lived the life George Harrison has to this point, and still have come out with his head screwed on straight, to me, seems to be a minor miracle. But to be able to rise above that level of living in the material world, to make the effort he has toward the enlightenment of himself and others, is to me highly commendable.
You have not gone off and said, okay, now today I'm going to get into meditation and tomorrow. I mean, this is something that's been constant with you long enough now that...
Yeah, I think John jeopardized his position a lot in the early 70s, late 60s. He was sort of saying, this is it. No, it isn't. Now it's this. You know, he went through a real scatty period from 68 till...
But that's also him. He was a searcher. He's a seeker. He goes from...
But he was so forceful, you know, I know just talking personally about him, when he was... But at least the good thing with John was he'd say, okay, I was wrong, one eye.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and he'd own up, but...
Don't like what John says? Stick around for 5 minutes. Well, not guilty then, that's kind of a segue into that.
Right. Well, I wrote that right after we got back from the Himalayas with Maharishi. I got back a bit later than everybody else. They all split and started Apple. And I got back and it was like a madhouse. In fact, to this day, it's still trying to untangle it. But that time, John and Yoko would just got together. They had some guy throwing the I Ching every 10 minutes, you know. Oh, we're having a business meeting. Well, let's throw the I Ching, you know. And the place was just full of lunatics. And so it was around that time. And it was really about John Paul Apple.
Yeah, I'm not guilty for...
looking like a freak, making friends with every Sikh. You know, they're those guys with the turbans, the Indians.
Not guilty.
Also about, I'm sorry that you're underfed.
Well, that was just something to rhyme with said.
Oh, I see. Wait, 5 minutes ago you were telling us you don't put anything in there if it's not real?
Oh, yeah, but it's true. There's a lot of people underfed. You know, that, in a way, is like the story of the first time I went to India. I felt guilty that I didn't have a hump on my back or leprosy. You know, because you see all these people and you think, oh God, what is, it's awful. And then you start looking at yourself and you're rich and handsome and healthy. You know, I felt bad about that. And then I realized karma, that's it. Look out, kid, it's something you did, God knows when, but you're doing it again. It's your own karma. So, you know, I'm not going to worry my life just because I haven't got a hump on my back.
Is it true that your lawyer called you up and advised you to sue yourself for Here Comes the Moon? I mean, is that true,
no,
George?
No.
Didn't say that you ought to sue yourself?
Because those two tunes aren't anything alike anyway.
It was a joke, George.
Yeah,
Jesus Christ.
Oh, well, but, I mean, things like that can happen. No, that's like the Ruttles, you know, he sued himself by mistake.
I think we've talked all around this, but in love comes to everyone something in your heart.
Yeah, there in your heart, something that's never changing. Well, that feeling is there in the heart. Actually, the heart is the part of the body where God resides.
Are you talking about physically?
Physically.
Really?
Well, spirit, that's the physical position of in the body. If you look at the chart in yoga, there's these energy centers. Now, there's the chakra at the heart, which is where the feeling of love comes from. You know, if you feel sick, you feel it in the chakra in the stomach. If you feel love, you feel it in the heart. And that's unchanging. The only thing that changes is the bodily condition. From the womb, you're a baby, and you're a boy, and you're a young man, and you're middle-aged, you turn into an old man, and you die. You know, you come out of this shape, this fetus bent over, and you come until you're up like this, and then you end up going bent over, and you die. But the one thing that's remained the same all through it is that soul in the heart. That thing comes from life to death to life to death. Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita says, there's never a time when we weren't, and there'll never be a time when we cease to be. The only thing that changes is bodily condition.
Now listen, I will keep you here to the last possible second, but because you've been, you know, some nice stuff, you tell me when you have to get up.
Well, we've maybe rounded off now.
Right now?
Yeah.
Okay.
If you have one or two more, we can do that.
So the last question, George, is when is Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young going to reform?
Well, I think they have to split up again first.
Split up again and then reform.
Yeah.
Well, man,
I think John Denver's splitting up.
Yeah, fine. That's good. Finally. Anyway, thank you for being
thank
here.
Thank you, Jim.
And
it's
I know
a pleasure.
You had a lot of stuff to do today, so just say good night to America.
Okay, good night, America.
My personal thanks and appreciation go to one Russ Thyrette, Vice President of Warner Brothers Records, who was completely responsible for arranging this conversation. Also, my personal thanks to my partner Jack Morris and to Robbie Carroll of Interview Incorporated. I'm Jim Ladd.